This is MergerCast by Booz Allen Hamilton, a podcast exploring the world of mergers, acquisitions, and restructurings.
Welcome to episode 2 of MergerCast by Booz Allen Hamilton. I'm Farrell Kramer, and I'm your host. The topic for this episode is merger communications. Our guest is Jerry Adolph, Senior Vice President of Booz Allen and head of its restructuring and integration group. Jerry recently wrote an article for Corporate Dealmaker magazine where he argued that a good merger communications program is a requirement for successful transactions. A good communications program enables management to spell out from the beginning what will constitute success. It also lays out the metrics management will use to measure the company's progress toward its goals. In our interview, Jerry expands upon these points and provides additional detail. It is an important interview for anyone contemplating a merger. Let's go straight to our interview.
MergerCast by Booz Allen Hamilton.
Hello, Jerry. Welcome back to the show. Why don't we just start with a couple of questions that are general in nature, and then we'll go on to the more specific. Your article in Corporate Dealmaker talks about the importance of communicating the process of your merger integration to the ultimate success of the transaction. What is the cost of failure in this communications effort?
Well, interestingly, that question underlies why I wrote this article in the first place. I was in a conversation with a client, a CFO, who was talking about some of the questions and pressures that they were getting from both internal management and outside investors, and was really asking about how to avoid some of the pitfalls that he was running into. The consequences of not being able to communicate really clearly and crisply what's going on in your merger, the consequences come up in a number of different ways. From a project management point of view, it's highly likely that not everybody knows what's going on and not everyone is on the same page as to who should do what, if in fact you can't report the results out and the activities out in a clean and effective manner.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to manage expectations, whether that is the expectations of internal management, the board, or other stakeholders, or the expectations of the investor community and the reporting community.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, you find yourself doing a lot of rework. If you weren't able to communicate, it was probably because we weren't able to track. And if we aren't able to track, we don't know that we are on track. And the net result is you wind up having to do some things over or differently.
I see. And what are the audiences for this communication? I imagine it extends beyond simply the press and investors.
The kind of communication you want coming out of a merger or as you go through a merger, there are a bunch of different audiences, but it's the same communication packaged different ways. So there's an audience that certainly is the financial and investment community.
Mm-hmm.
There's an audience that are the employees. There's an audience that is internal management and middle management, both those involved in the merger and those impacted by the merger, but not directly involved. And then depending on the nature of your industry, if you're in utilities or healthcare or something like that, there are a whole host of other stakeholders, regulators, politicians, local community groups, other people who are in the channel, either ahead of you or behind you, all of whom have something to say about what's going on or at least some interest in what's going on. At its core, there are different messages that you'd want to deliver to each of those constituencies, but they all have to hang together. We can't go into one place and say to the employees, well, everything will be fine, there'll be no layoffs, and then go into the financial community and say, by the way, we're going to get, you know, tons and tons of synergy from that particular location. Those messages don't hang together. So that's what I meant by it being the same message, but delivered in different ways to different audiences.
I see. You know, it seems at its core, this is really about setting and managing expectations for the transaction. Is it fairly similar then to, say, public companies offering earnings guidance to the investment community?
This is much more granular than typical earnings guidance. There are, of course, all sorts of rules as to what you can and cannot say and can and cannot give out in the process of giving formal earnings guidance. This is really trying to communicate very specifically whether or not we are on track or off track, preferably on track, obviously.
Yes.
And what kind of progress we're making and how we're measuring it and what the results are that are falling to the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interestingly, in the process of communicating at a very granular level, particularly about cost synergies and revenue upsides, most people are interested in avoiding running afoul of the overall financial reporting requirements. You don't want to give out too much too soon. And so what you have to do is you have to find a way to be very specific in your communications of your results without making predictions about your future earnings and profitability that are inappropriate.
Right, right. You write in the story that this merger communications effort begins by determining just how to measure merger success. At what stage in the process does this need to take place?
Well, if you mean at what stage do you need to determine how to measure?
Yes,
that,
yes.
That happens right up at the very beginning. Today, as part of any announcement of a transaction, there's some statement as to where the value in the transaction lies. And while that statement will almost always consist of growth and cost components, usually that statement goes a little bit further and speaks to the balance between the two. You know, on balance, this is a growth transaction. On balance, this is a synergy and roll-up transaction. And then furthermore, there are usually some broad categories of savings that might be mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But as you go through the integration planning and you begin to create very detailed integration tasks and very detailed synergy estimates, it is at that point that you really put the meat on the bones as to what you're going to measure, how you're going to measure it, and from then, communicating actually becomes simply a matter of packaging and getting the right tone for the right constituencies.
I see. Can you provide some examples of what kind of metrics might be good ones for measuring success? And then on the flip side, what type of metrics to stay away from?
There are two broad categories of metrics. Within any merger planning process, and then ultimately within the merger itself, there are two general things that I want to know. How am I doing against the actual tasks of integrating? That is to say, the tasks that get me from being one company or, I'm sorry, get me from being two companies or three companies to be one fully functioning company. Those metrics are relatively straightforward, and they tend to be project metrics. On date X, we will change the name of this legal entity. We'll take the sign down in front of the building, and we'll put the sign up. Very easy to measure, very easy to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
The financial metrics are the ones that are a little trickier because you're trying to be specific and granular, but again, you don't want to get out in front of your official financial reporting and make inappropriate predictions. So what we usually try to do is to make those metrics very tangible. Purchase goods and services, assets, headcount, and revenue. And if you think about it, virtually any cost or growth upside can be expressed in one of those four terms.
Mm-hmm.
And frequently, if you can't put it into one of those four terms, it's not real money. So the ones that you want to stay away from or the ones you want to think a little bit harder about are the vague kinds of metrics, things that are FTEs, for example, as opposed to actual headcount reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Best practice sharing, you'll see, you know, we're going to save money by best practice sharing. Yes, you will, but you need to now go the next step and say, what are the heads that leave the organization? What are the assets that get reduced? And what are the purchase goods and services that are reduced as a result of that best practice sharing? It's not meant to say that if I can't reduce it to one of those four, it's not a good thing to do. There are some things that one needs to do and should do to capture best practices, to transfer knowledge, to clean up the way the organization operates that are very positive and useful things to do. They're just not measurable as synergies, and therefore you can't communicate them as such.
I see. How should management go about communicating those metrics the street should be following? I imagine for a public company, for example, we're looking at things like press releases, SEC filings, and roadshows.
Throughout the life of the transaction, the vehicles for communication will evolve. Early on, there are very specific and dedicated roadshows, very targeted messages to different stakeholder groups, to the analyst group, to people who will be voting on perhaps approval of the transaction. And as you get toward the end of a merger, the actual implementation period, eventually it settles into the normal financial reporting routine, be it the quarterly reports and the SEC filings. And in fact, at some point, people usually want to stop reporting on the merger per se and go back to a more normal reporting of their financials and their other results, even though there may still be merger activity going on. At what point does that transition occur? It varies by deal. Certainly, if you're still taking any kinds of special charges or reserves, you're going to want to say something about why that is and what the results are that are flowing from that. At the point where much of the activity has transferred to line management, much of the financial activity is encompassed in a normal set of P&L line items as opposed to special charges or special upsides, that's pretty much the point where you can go back to more normal kinds of reporting.
Should management provide targets for the success metrics at certain points in the future? And what would those periods be? For example, 6 months post-close and then 1 year post-close, et cetera, et cetera?
You absolutely should provide some targets. I think that if you go back to the categories, let's stick with financial for a moment. If you go back to those categories that I mentioned, you absolutely want to say something about costs and when those costs will be realized at a full run rate. And you want to talk about revenues, and those will probably come at some different point in time. On integration tasks, the things that are not directly related perhaps to synergies, you want to talk about when, in fact, major milestone activities will occur. Now, the exact timing of those things are to be determined as part of your integration planning. And some of them are also pegged to just the external expectations. So if I've said to the street that this deal will be accretive within 2 years, obviously I need to report on some financial results that will get me to that over that period. And at the point at which it is accretive, then I probably don't need to say anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If I've said for business stability reasons or for customer transition reasons or other reasons, this is going to unfold over a 3-year period. Well, now I've set a different expectation about what that time frame is.
I see.
How I then report on the interim, like do I have to report every week, every month, every quarter? Other than the statutory reporting requirements, that's really a function of just how much activity is going on and the extent to which I need to prepare the outside world to hear the messages that they'll hear in the formal reports.
You say in the article that management should resist the urge to sandbag, but what should management do if, for example, despite its best efforts, it begins to miss some of its marks?
Well, by sandbagging, what I was referring to, of course, is dramatically understating what it is you're going to deliver. But no one, you know, just to be honest, as we say amongst us kids, no one ever goes out and announces and promises the full array of benefits they think they're going to get. And that's mainly because any decent integration plan has some stretch goals and some stretch aspirations that probably go beyond what you're comfortable actually promising. And you never really want to fall short against what you say.
Mm-hmm.
So typically you'll go out and you'll make some promise that is a little bit below what you actually think you might get. But you don't want it to be dramatically below, because just as with any other kind of reporting, if you come back in and deliver results that are significantly above what you've said, in this day and age, that actually stretches your credibility just about as much as missing.
Right. So you need to be somewhere in the comfortable range of what you can achieve, certainly not a stretch goal, but also not a sandbag goal.
The comfortable range of reasonableness. and here's why that's important. Let's say, for example, I think that I can deliver $100 million, but I only say 50. And now later on, I really start to hit the ball out of the park, and I'm delivering close to 100, maybe even a little more than that.
Mm-hmm.
If I've not set the appropriate expectations, the analyst may very well take that additional upside. They don't know where it's come from, and build it into my going forward expectations as if it were going to continue forever. Well, I've now created a problem for myself.
Yes.
If I want to avoid that problem by saying, well, guess what? I really found 110 when I only told you 50. Now I have a credibility problem.
Right. And that indeed is counterproductive.
Right. And it's pretty obvious that on the other side, if I've said I'm going to deliver 50 and I underperform, that's never a particularly good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is incumbent on us to do the detailed level of planning in the planning phase that allows you to then make some promises that are reasonable and within range.
Lastly, who should be responsible for this merger communications effort? Should it fall to the investor relations folks, or is it more of a CEO-CFO responsibility?
I think the general reporting of financials and progress against financial targets in this day and age primarily fall to the CFO, with the investor relations community doing follow-up and Q&A with investors. But there's, as I said at the outset, a much broader array of stakeholders with whom to communicate. And even your roadshows, even your analyst briefings, have a much broader audience than just that investment community. And so from that point of view, it is certainly something that early on in the transaction, it's a CEO-CFO responsibility. Because you're usually not just talking about, you know, I reduced assets by this much, or I cut procurement by a few dollars here and there. You're usually also reporting on the overall health and tone of the organization, the overall feel and spirit of the people, the reaction of customers to the transaction, your ability to deal smoothly with suppliers and to run operations. It's really a much broader picture of what's going on. As you get later and later into the implementation, once again, you can go back to some more normal kinds of communication channels and more normal spokesmen.
All right. Well, that wraps up all my questions, Jerry. Do you have anything further you'd like to add?
I think the only thing I'd really like to add is, going back to what I said at the outset, that having the ability to communicate in a clean and crisp manner what's going on, what your progress is, and what the expectations and results are is just so critical in a merger. It's critical in any circumstance, but in a large merger, the entire management team is suspect. You start off with some credibility in operations. In this day and age, where many mergers are considered to be risky or to be tenuous, or you've seen all the statistics on how many fail, there's a bit of skepticism when you initially announce one of these things. And so the ability to reassure the financial markets, the stakeholders, and the employees that we are under control is just paramount. And even when things are going badly, or even when things are going well, the ability to transmit that we are under control, we know what's happening, we're out in front of it, we're taking appropriate actions, that's most of the battle.
I see. Well, very interesting topic, Jerry. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
MergerCast by Booz Allen Hamilton.
This concludes our interview with Jerry Adolph. Merger communications is a topic that you don't hear a great deal about. However, Jerry's comments make clear that it represents one area you don't want to forget about as you move from a merger's concept to execution. Thank you for listening to Episode 2 of MergerCast by Booz Allen Hamilton. We've got a number of interesting episodes coming up, so please stay with us as we continue to explore the world of mergers, acquisitions, and restructurings.
This has been MergerCast by Booz Allen Hamilton. For more information on Booz Allen's service offerings in mergers and restructurings, please visit www.boozallen.com.